Hello and welcome to the Voices of World Christianity podcast. My name is Noam.
And I'm Chow.
And today with us, we have our special guest, Andrew Ong. Andrew is a former student at the Center of World Christianity based at the University of Edinburgh. He submitted his PhD in 2019 and he now currently works as a pastor in the San Francisco Bay Area. Andrew, would you like to say a few words of introduction?
Hey, Noam. Hey, Chow. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here, talk about world Christianity, which I believe is a super important field. A little bit about myself. I'm a third generation Chinese American from the San Francisco Bay Area. Have been back in the San Francisco Bay Area since finishing my PhD at University of Edinburgh. Currently pastoring a church in the Evangelical Presbyterian Church called Christ Church East Bay. It's right there in Berkeley, just a couple blocks from the University of California, and very much enjoying ministering and using all the things that I got at University of Edinburgh, along with being a parent of two young daughters, two and one. So looking forward to chatting today.
Sounds great. I noticed at your introduction, you said the words, you're a third generation Chinese American. So I thought maybe that's a good starting point for our conversation today. We're hoping to chat about Chinese American identity and Christianity and church life. So why, I guess I'll be blunt, why do you identify as a third generation Chinese American? Why those words? Why those labels?
Yeah, that's really a important and good question. I think identify as a third generation Chinese American. First of all, just I'm Chinese. That's the kind of Asian American that I am. And yeah, I mean, I've always known I was American, but I think I've always felt like there's something unique to my inhabiting this American space. And I would say it's that I'm Chinese. Third generation kind of speaks to the kind of Chinese American I am. Most mm-hmm. Chinese American Christians came to the States post 1965. After the 1965 Hart-Celler Act, right, you have these highly skilled, highly educated people being brought in, mostly from the Chinese diaspora, right? You have Taiwan, Hong Kong, or Southeast Asia coming in. But third generation, like myself, my grandparents came in illegally in like the 40s and the 50s, paper names through Angel Island, fleeing the communist takeover in China. And so it's a slightly different kind of stock, less educated, but a lot of them were fairly well off or well to do. They had the money to make the trip. And mm-hmm. a lot of the reason why they were leaving was because the communist government had taken so much of their property. So whatever they had left, that means that, you know, most of them had some means, right, back in China. So yeah, those are my people. And that's why, you know, I don't speak Mandarin. I have a Cantonese background, but even then I don't even speak Cantonese because my parents growing up in like the 50s and 60s, different than today's Asian Americans, were told don't keep your language, assimilate into the American culture. So my parents only speak English now, even though their parents kind of spoke to them in Cantonese. So I think for all those reasons, I kind of identify as a third generation Chinese American, which is, I've noticed, is different from my Taiwanese friends, right? Or my, or people like Chow. So,
yeah, that's, you know, Noam, I think it's a really great question. And that number in front can make a huge difference because it tells a lot about, actually, you know, it tells a lot about the background of a person. For example, Andrew is a third generation. I identify as a 1.5 generation. And you're like, well, that's really strange. Why 1.5, right? Well, it's because I was born in China. But I immigrated to the U.S. At a very young age. And most Chinese Americans who immigrate to the U.S. at a very young age, typically they do not speak Chinese by the time they become teenagers or adults. But with my situation, it's a little different because my father, he felt it was really important that I maintain my mother tongue. And for that reason, at some point I lost my Chinese, but then I picked it up starting at the age of 8. I attended Chinese school, and a lot of the Chinese American listeners will know about these schools. They're typically held in churches. They're on Sundays, they're in Sunday mornings. And we studied for 2 hours, and I went for like 8 years. To be honest, I didn't learn very much. I I think my parents got a really bad return of investment on those years. Maybe like paid like $50 per Chinese character that I learned. But you know, my parents also were really wise because they sent me back to China to kind of like, we call it 寻根, which is to seek our roots. Almost every summer since I was 14 or 15. So I've gone back to China like over a dozen times. And it helped me to stay connected with my fam, my country of origin. I had different impressions of China as I went to different parts of China throughout the years. And through the 90s, you know, we saw the rebuilding of China, the kind of the China becoming wealthier. So it's really fascinating to see all that. But then for me, my Chinese mostly picked up because after college, I went to China to work. I worked in a Chinese company. My coworkers are all Chinese. Eventually, I went to a Chinese church where I was baptized. You know, so this is just immersion, pure immersion through life, work, church life. Andrew was talking about his grandparents, and it's such a fascinating thing to hear about them coming over because, you know, I thought about my parents who came over in the mid 80s, and they came over not because of U.S. policies, but they came over because of a changing Chinese policy, which allowed for college graduates to leave the country and seek more further education in the West. My father, actually, he left the country in 1984, and he was part of the first wave of the Chinese educated mainlanders to come to the U.S. to study. So that's why, you know, nowadays we see a lot of pretty well-educated first-generation Chinese Americans in their 50s and 60s, because most of them came during that time, during the 80s when that immigration finally opened up from the Chinese side.
So are these kind of questions of identity and labels something that you've kind of encountered not only in your personal life, but in your professional life, Andrew?
Yeah, definitely. I would say so. I think I currently pastor, I'm an assistant pastor at a multi-ethnic church. We're probably, I don't know, 65 to 70% white. White American, and then maybe, I don't know, 25% like Asian, like South Asian, East Asian. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, maybe 5 to 10% Black, Latino. I think, you know, before me, the staff, when I got there, the staff was completely white American. And I like to think that coming from where I've come from, the church backgrounds that I have, just the way I understand how to do relationships, mm-hmm. Has very much been shaped by, I would say, my Chinese Americanness, the Chinese churches that I grew up in, and even the Korean churches that I attended in college when I was kind of exploring this multi-Asian American evangelical space. So I would definitely say I think it's affected my professional life as well.
Mm-hmm. It's a random thing, but I remember because we kind of, for the listener, Andrew and I crossed paths because our my master's year and his PhD years overlapped at Edinburgh. And I remember when you were, you know, I think maybe just on the edge of leaving Edinburgh, I remember a blog post that you wrote where you were kind of trying to decide what the future held for you. And you were choosing between, I might have misremembered this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but you were choosing between two kind of different, quite different roles. And one would have been the role that you have now. And the other one, I can't quite remember, but I remember reading your blog post, which was quite a thoughtful reflection on how the ministry that you enter or which position you enter would then kind of had implications on who you identified and who you worked with, who you identified with and who you worked with. I don't know if you remember this.
You have a great memory. I'm honored that you even read that.
Noah. It's because I'm very creepy. So, you know, don't be too flattered. But yeah, go on. Sorry.
You know, my whole life, I grew up in the Chinese American church, a second generation Chinese American church. And that's where I discerned my call to pastoral ministry. So naturally, I always envisioned like doing that kind of ministry, right? Until the doors for that were completely shut, right? And yeah, this whole vision I had of the kind of pastor I was going to be, the kind of Christian I was going to be, just, I would say God forced it to shift, right? Thankfully, I think having gone through the University of Edinburgh, getting a PhD in world Christianity, reflecting on what it means to be a Chinese American evangelical, I was able to bring that very intentionally into my multi-ethnic church space, not just kind of going in and trying to play the game, but trying to go in and represent and influence and share the beautiful diversity that's in the, even in just the American church itself, right? Not even including the whole global church. So yeah, good memory, Noam.
Very cool, Andrew. I was curious, you know, you mentioned a couple times now already that your education at the University of Edinburgh was quite impactful to, you know, your current role as a pastor. Could you tell us a little more about how it has changed your vision of pastoring a church?
Yeah, thanks. It's a big question. I would say, I mean, first of all, it's just taught me to think critically, right? To think like a PhD, and it comes in handy. Like a lot of our, we're on the north side of Berkeley, so we get a lot more of the grad students than undergrads. We have grad students at our church. We have faculty members at our church, you know, people, researchers, staff, and it just helps to think like they do, right? To think like these people do. But I would say, particularly in my studies, what's helped me from the University of Edinburgh that I've transferred into my ministry life is, I think, well, first of all, in Berkeley, you have a lot of, you know, I think you've heard of this ex-evangelical narrative, a lot of deconstruction. So we're working with a lot of people who are going through that. And Berkeley is a place that feeds on Oakland, Berkeley. They feed on this deconstruction narrative. A lot of our people are getting into, you know, liberation theologies and post-colonial theologies and, you know, with the rise of Trump, just anti-evangelical sentiment. And so I'm engaging with these kinds of people who are like just wanting to throw out the baby with the bathwater in a lot of senses, just completely reject their evangelical heritage and past for a lot of good reasons, honestly. But in my PhD, what I tried to do was I tried to engage with the concerns that people have with evangelicalism. So, and I was able to do that with Chinese American evangelicalism, because Chinese American evangelicals have by and large kind of uncritically adopted popular and conservative American evangelicalism. So I was able to make a critique of Chinese American evangelicals, and really by doing that, critique popular and conservative American evangelicalism itself. So I think being able to make those critiques to understand why these people are flirting with maybe leaving the faith or deconstructing it significantly, to be able to even articulate those problems and issues they have with Christianity and Western evangelicalism, I think gives a lot of cred, right? And to be able to articulate what they find wrong with evangelicals probably better than they can, gives a lot of cred, right? Mm-hmm. But also to represent as an example of someone who understands those concerns and critiques, yet has not walked away, mm-hmm. but has kind of doubled down and said, you know, I really want to be a Chinese American evangelical. I think it's important, and there's a good way to do it. I think we've been inconsistent, but I think there's a good way to do it. And here's a way. Mm-hmm. So, and that kind of gets to the second part of my PhD, where I try to offer some constructive ways forward.
Yeah, your PhD was fascinating reading. I had a very quick skim through it before in preparation for this, and I thought it was really, really interesting how, because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you're trying to kind of, like you said, like walk the line between like, yeah, there are problems with a particular brand of evangelicalism, or perhaps the most well-known brand of evangelicalism, but that doesn't mean that, like you said, we should throw the baby out of the bathwater. There are still remnants of it that are useful, that are that we can learn from, that we need to learn from. But at the same time, we do need to nuance it, in particular for the kind of your audience, which are Chinese American Christians. And I wonder if you could speak more about what you think evangelicalism or kind of mainstream Christianity needed to address for the Chinese American experience that it wasn't doing at that present time.
Yeah, no, that's a really great leading question for me. The first issue that I raised, this being a PhD titled Toward a Chinese American Evangelical Theology, was evangelicalism, Western American conservative evangelicalism's kind of deficient, I call it a deficient theology of race and ethnicity, particularly in multi-ethnic spaces, multi-ethnic churches like my own. You know, in the past, I don't know, I would say two decades, they've kind of, evangelicals in America have kind of been pounding the drum of, yeah, multi-ethnicity. Yeah, let's bring all the tribes together. We're going to be a Revelation 7 church. But I love Sung Chan Ra's line that so often what that happens to be is maybe you have a mixed salad bowl, but it gets drenched in creamy ranch, right? And yeah, there's a uniformity even to that supposedly diverse multi-ethnic church. Mm-hmm. So that's the, kind of the first thing I address, evangelicalism's deficient theology of ethnicity, this kind of smoothing out of differences in the name of equality, right? But I think if we're more nuanced thinkers, we don't seek equality through uniformity. We seek unity with diversity at the same time. Mm-hmm. That's something that being at Edinburgh helped me to understand better, particularly talking to Alex, our supervisor, and also James from a neo-Calvinist perspective. So that's the first thing I kind of tackle, like, hey, it's okay to say that we're different and to play those up, actually. And that doesn't have to be at the expense of unity. Mm-hmm. Actually, to flatten our differences, that's what's going to result in more tribalism eventually.
Yeah.
So I talk about that as a problem within evangelicalism. I talk about evangelicals often poor like cultural engagement. So why aren't we as activistic as Black Lives Matter or, you know, these different movements around the world that are really making waves? Why are we, you know, content with just keeping our doctrine pure and maybe having our pietistic expression of Christianity and not actually trying to bear witness to the kingdom of God in society and in spaces that aren't simply Christian, right? And I talked about multiple ways that, you know, that happens. Like the Western Evangelical Church has been very individualistic, right? So if you're about me and my Bible only, you know, you don't need to worry about society or even the language of systemic structural issues. That's not even like on your mind. You don't even have that language, right? That vocabulary, if you have a very individualistic faith. So I talk about that, the need for a more, not for a collectivist, but to have a balanced individual and collectivist mindset. I talk about things like, you know, if you have a more strict spiritual material dualism, then you're not going to care for the poor, right? You might share the gospel with a homeless person, but you won't care that much about their grumbling belly, right? So I talk about that as another way that we, another reason why we haven't been as engaged socially as we ought. And then, you know, just the anti-intellectualism that's been in Western evangelicalism or the supposedly all political. I think being all political is like not truly being all political, but the stance of many, especially Chinese American evangelicals. So I touch upon those things as well as ways that we have not been faithfully bearing witness to the kingdom of God with our whole lives, right? So those are kind of the critiques I leveled.
Andrew, I think you brought up some really important critiques. And, you know, I also looked at your thesis. And as I was thinking about it, you're really straddling a line on the kind of the Caucasian Western evangelicalism and the Chinese American evangelicalism, right? I mean, how much do these overlap? I think is something that's really important to discuss. But also coming from my perspective, and I'd like to share a little bit, is that I'm coming from the immigrant church perspective, which is, you know, when we talk about Chinese American evangelicalism, there's also a need to differentiate between immigrant and second gen, right? I'm sure you agree with that. Mm-hmm. I kind of like to hear what you think about what are some of the challenges that the Chinese American evangelical church, whether it's immigrant or second gen, and I maybe will speak a little more on the immigrant after your response, but what challenges are there to understanding and then adopting neo-Calvinism as you propose in your thesis?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I would say you're totally correct that everything that I've just said so far, at the front of my PhD, I explicitly talked about I was focusing on English speaking, like second generation Chinese American, second and after generation Chinese Americans. So I hope that qualification is understood here. And so your question of what are some obstacles to second and on generation Chinese American evangelicals adopting this neo-Calvinism that I proposed in my thesis? Well, first of all, what is neo-Calvinism? Neo-Calvinism is a post-Enlightenment reformed movement that came out of like the Dutch Netherlands. Its pioneer was Abraham Kuyper. I would say its chief like thinker though was Herman Bavinck. And it was not seeking to be like a paleo-Calvinism, just like a repristination of what Calvin talked about in Geneva and just boom, put it into this modern post-Enlightenment world. But it was really a development, I would say, of it in a postmodern world. Where you're engaging with pluralistic ideas and you have thinkers who are less modernistic and rationalistic, right? This is a tradition that was developed in different ways, like in America and in Europe in different ways. I would start there with a more historical definition of it. And some of the key things of the neo-Calvinist tradition are a strong theology of creation, right? It's not just about how to get saved, but it's wanting to tell the whole story of creation, fall, all the way to new creation. So, and it has that strong theology of creation informing other parts of its theology and the fall. So you have this understanding that everything was good, but it was broken and misdirected. But God is going to do something about that in Christ. So I would say that that's really what it is. But again, it comes out of the Reformed tradition. So you have a lot of Presbyterian-ish Reformed people who kind of take up this tradition, which I would say is maybe an obstacle to second and third generation Chinese Americans who have been very much influenced by the Baptistic and holiness traditions. It can seem kind of maybe too academic for them or too high church, this, you know, Reformed Presbyterian tradition. It could seem, maybe even too Western. you might argue that. But I would say some of those obstacles are simply like the sources of authority that a second and third generation might look to, right? Not very many of them will have been significantly been influenced by the neo-Calvinist tradition. So it's kind of it'd be a step outside of your comfort zone, outside of the voices that you trust to listen to a Bavinck or something like that, you know, where you might be happy with your Rick Warren Christianity, you know, and your Norman Geisler systematic theology or John MacArthur for, you know, the Neo-Calvinist tradition is a step away from that. And, you know, this is kind of the beginning of the movement in terms of things being translated in English. So just not a lot has been out there. There's just not that much exposure to it yet. But I'm hopeful. I think Tim Keller has done a lot. Tim Keller says Bavinck is the modern theologian that you should be reading. So I think that will go a long way toward the future.
Well, that depends on what your opinion of Tim Keller is, though. So,
well, I mean, among second and yeah, no, that's a good point. I would say among second and third generations, mm-hmm. Tim Keller's become more of a trusted, evangelical voice to them, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. So I think that's a reason why. Yeah,
it's interesting that you say you're hopeful about, you know, the prospects of Neo-Calvinism among these churches, because one thing that you did in your PhD was you did engage with Pentecostal voices in primarily through Amos Young. And the reason I bring that up is because I think I mentioned to you earlier that Chao was looking at charismatic Chinese American churches, and I thought there would be some interesting conversations to be had. Mm. I don't know, Chao, if you want to chime in with some of your findings so far.
Andrew, I think you brought up some really interesting points about it being too high church, maybe too foreign, too Western. Right. As I was thinking about the immigrant Chinese American church, that is absolutely true. I mean, the immigrant Chinese church is still very much rooted in the mainland Chinese thinkers of the 1950s. Right. So we got Watchman Nee, you know, John Sun, Little Flock. In fact, there's so many Little Flock churches here in California. A lot of these theologies are very much dualistic, right? Very dualistic. I hear the concept of, you know, the world being evil and all things in the world are, you know, the material things are evil, you know, to that kind of an extreme degree, right? I can think of, for the immigrant Chinese church, language and translation being probably the biggest barrier. But we know we have now a student at New College, Simeon.
Oh, he's still there.
He's still there. He graduated, but he's been translating a lot of Bavinck's work into Chinese. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very interesting.
Right. Yeah. I think, you have in China a certain intellectual kind of wing, or a lot of cultural Christians as well, right? You have like Huang Yi and things like that, who are kind of picking up on these things, or you have Stephen Tong picking up on this Neo-Calvinist tradition, but it's very like high level. And these are like academics and thinkers and theologians. But when it comes to like the Chinese American immigrant church, like it's going to be a while.
What I'm finding in my research is that rather than going the route of the high church or maybe the systematic theology, more churches are going towards the way of the charismatic side, the Pentecostal third wave type.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think, and I would say in one sense, being into systematic theology, for someone to even say something like that, demonstrates a measure of their privilege, right? And I would say, if you're going to talk about which church the second and third gen Chinese American evangelical church versus the immigrant church is more privileged, of course, it's going to be the second and third gen, right? Immigrant church is filled with people who are probably still, you know, working blue collar jobs, have little tiny restaurants in Chinatown, being supported by their children who have, you know, gone off and are now software engineers, right? So I think that's a big reason, like the questions you ask are different, right? You're seeking healing in a different way versus maybe intellectual like stimulation about these deeper questions, right? So that makes total sense to me. And I do think, though, in general, like I'm finding particularly amongst even just white post-evangelicals here in Berkeley and Oakland, it's not just it's not simply a rejection of Christianity that people are necessarily choosing with their deconstruction, but a lot of them are choosing as part of their deconstruction more like mystical and spiritual renewalist traditions. So I think that, you know, the Pentecostal charismatic movements actually scratch that itch for a handful of people in a world where we're all understanding, like, there's actually a lot that we don't know and understand. And, you know, the modernistic kind of, we're going to get it all figured out, that's kind of been demolished. So people, I think, are more open to things like that, even as they're open to conspiracy theories, you know, but it's just part of the whole package.
That's a really interesting point that you talked about there, Andrew, about how there is an element of a class aspect towards which kind of church that people might feel more at home to. And I don't know, is that something that you think, well, I guess I've got two questions. Is that something that you think that you've seen personally? There's a kind of among your own kind of like ministry experience in ministry, there's a kind of element of like, where do people feel most comfortable as someone who is, I don't know, I guess it might be most helpful to talk about in terms of comfort. Like for those of you who don't know, I now attend the same church as Chow did, and that's a predominantly Chinese, but you know, there's other Asians in there as well. And the part of the reason why I migrated from my white church is because I felt more comfortable among other people who weren't from the same country, but who at least had a similar enough background. And I don't know whether or not, you know, has this issue of like comfort ever kind of, or belonging, or where feels familiar, been something that you've come across in your ministry or in your research? And then the second question is whether or not we do need to engage with a kind of class dimension when we're talking, when we're doing ministry, when we're doing outreach as a church or as a ethnic church or as a multiracial church.
Yeah, great questions. I hope I can remember both of them. Yeah, so I would say comforts and preferences, they, of course, they factor in. And, you know, I think some people would say that, well, that's awful. It should just be about doctrine or Christ. And sure. Those things are important too. But I think, you know, again, we are students of the Center of World Christianity, the study of world Christianity. So we lament Andrew Wall's passing just very recently, right? But what did he teach? He taught the indigenizing principle and the pilgrim principle. So these comforts that we feel, well, definitely they can be overboard, and it could kind of become an echo chamber or a tribe or a consumeristic church where we just kind of are united not in Christ, but in our consumeristic preferences. That's the radical extreme of that. But there's also something to comfort in which that's part of the indigenizing principle, right?
Sorry, just to interrupt you, could you talk a bit more about the indigenizing principle for those of us who aren't aware of the great Andrew Walls?
Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, so Andrew Walls talked about the indigenizing principle and the pilgrim principle, and he said, the gospel, wherever it goes, there's this indigenous element where it can very much find its home anywhere. And there's this, every culture has this receptivity to the gospel. Every culture has something that shines when the gospel light is shined upon it. And at the same time, the gospel always challenges every culture. So if you're a person bringing the gospel into another place, you're going to find that they resonate with things because of the indigenous principle, but you're also going to find that you're going to feel lonely because of the pilgrim principle, and people are not going to like some of the things about the gospel. So I would say when we feel comfortable in a church because of cultural reasons, I would say a lot of that is not just because we're being consumeristic Christians, though we need to be careful about that according to the pilgrim principle, but we can embrace it because of the indigenizing principle as well.
I was very struck by what you said at the beginning about mentioning how your church in particular interacts with people who are questioning their faith, people who are going through a process of deconstruction, or, you know, identifying ex-evangelicals, however you want to call it. And even I would argue that even those who still identify as Christian, such as myself, you know, I think it's quite normal and indeed healthy to kind of have a period or occasional periods in life where you kind of check that you're still okay with what the message you're being received is, check if it still aligns with all that kind of stuff, and rather than blindly accepting dogmas, I'm sure we all agree. But I was kind of struck by that and how one of the common critiques towards mainstream evangelicalism is the fact that it doesn't engage with social issues, such as the fact that a lot of people are living below the poverty line and they shouldn't be, such as things like Black Lives Matter, as you mentioned. And I wondered, is that something that you think Chinese evangelical churches need to be more aware of and need to engage seriously with? Is that something? Because certainly I think, you know, you've expressed the fact that evangelicalism as a mainstream kind of denomination or movement or whatever you want to call it, doesn't engage with it enough. Is that a problem within Chinese churches as well?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's probably an even bigger problem with the Chinese American evangelical church. I mean, if the Chinese American evangelical church kind of is behind the American evangelical church. So, you know, if people were reading Rick Warren 20 years ago, like the Chinese American evangelical church was reading them maybe 15 years ago, right? So same with, you know, the social justice movement. You have prominent evangelicals now, even people like John Piper talking about race and things like that. I think the Chinese American evangelical is kind of slowly ramping into that. So I would say that's a thing. But I would also say, and this is kind of speaks to Chow's expertise in the immigrant church, what the Chinese American church has done socially is care for their immigrant people. You might say that's selfish or whatever, but that is social, like if you're going to categorize it, right? So I would say that has always been a part of the tradition of the Chinese American evangelicals.
Yeah, I mean, for absolutely, Andrew, that's a really good point you bring up. For immigrant, right? We can imagine immigrants, they come to a new country, they don't know the community, they're probably not that great at the language. They're looking for people like them to, you know, get some support. Beyond that, they also need a lot of help with the culture too.
While we're on the topic of churches, I was kind of thinking back to what you said about Revelation 7 church, which has been, for those of you unfamiliar with Revelations, which is a lot of us, it kind of I presume, Andrew, correct me if I'm wrong, I presume it refers to the whole idea of a great multitude of believers coming from every nation, every tribe coming together under the banner of being a believer in Christ, and therefore a kind of a negation of identity, of race, of tribalism. And I was thinking back to what you said about how some people are skeptical or a little bit cautious of the need for a Chinese specific church or other ethnicity church. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on is there a need, or can we all fit underneath one banner? I can guess your answer, but elaborate yeah. more on that, if you will.
I mean, this is a topic that's important to me. It's the only academic paper I've actually published. Ooh, it's on
have
this
to check it out.
It's on neo-Calvinism and multi-ethnic churches, and basically I kind of take aim at this, what a lot of people are calling like the multi-ethnic church mandate, or like that's the only way to do it. I just think that
what is a multi-ethnic church mandate?
The multi-ethnic church mandate is that every church in you know, multi-ethnic areas, metropolitan areas or whatever, should be multi-ethnic, and they should be like representative demographically of the people, the demographics that they inhabit. I think that's just way too simplistic and probably another imposition of uniformity rather than nuanced unity with diversity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Chow has already spoken very well to the ways that a specifically ethnic immigrant church can serve a specific purpose. And I think it really presupposes, the multi-ethnic church mandate also presupposes a strong, like, independent congregationalism rather than a connectedness to, like, even to say, like, oh, every church should be multi-ethnic in, you know, San Francisco. Like, I want to say that's too small a view of the church. I would say the church already is multi-ethnic, you know, the universal church. Like, and of course there are good things about pursuing racial reconciliation and multi-ethnic spaces. I think, you know, there are tons of benefits, but to kind of blanket say, oh, the Chinese church shouldn't exist. Can you imagine if someone said the Black church shouldn't exist, right, in America?
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like the idea of like the language of racial reconciliation to me kind of screams alarm bells, because it feels like it's a way of glossing over some of the very specific harms that have been done against very specific groups of people. Racial reconciliation in the used as a means to uniformity, like you were saying, kind of makes me, I want to side eye it a lot, basically.
Oh yeah, it's triggering, right?
But no, genuinely, I think I'm skeptical of the usage of that term in this thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good sentiment and good intuition. So yeah, for that reason, I really think that it's very simplistic to issue a multi-ethnic mandate, even as multi-ethnic churches have their place, just as ethnic churches do, and they all have their dangers and their weaknesses and their pros and benefits. And we just need to enter that mix, that messy mix, right? And pursue the good.
So if I could ask a kind of a bold question, a challenging question, what does family, what does unity look like in a multi-ethnic church then? What's the solution, Andrew? Please fix our problems for us.
What does unity and family look like in a multi-ethnic church? As a Chinese-American pastor in a multi-ethnic church with a mostly white leadership, it looks like me being unashamedly Chinese American about the way that I preach, the kinds of stories that I tell, the language that I use, and the way I try to build community and foster family. So family has been huge, like the hospitality ministry that I try to embody is very different from our church. Like we just hang, we just give time to each other, right? I think it also means, yeah, playing up our differences. Like, oh, this Christian is from Africa. Let's talk about that, you know, and how some of our liturgies here are off-putting, you know, to our Scottish Presbyterian liturgies are off-putting to our guests. You know, I've preached at multiple like Asian American campus ministries and churches around the East Bay. And a handful of people will come and they'll visit Christ Church. Maybe they're leaving their things or they're looking for another church and they'll come and it's like, oh, well, I liked his preaching at the retreat, but like this liturgy, like this, they see two guys wearing clerical collars, you know, like even the musical style, it's not for me. So speaking amongst our leadership about those things, you know, and saying, hey, like, and I think it's also being honest. Like, I think a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to be a multi-ethnic church. I'm going to be a church for everyone. Mm-hmm. That's just impossible and naive and arrogant to me. Of course, we should be inclusive, but I also think like you're not going to get everyone and you got to make some calls, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. About like who you believe God is calling you to reach and to minister to. Mm-hmm. And that's a tough line to walk, right? Yeah, those are some of my initial thoughts, I would say.
Thank you. I know I asked you a big question.
We've been engaging in some pretty big topics, Andrew. And I think just from, you know, from an insider of the immigrant Chinese American church, I'm just really thankful for some of the ideas you brought up. And I hope that some of these things we talked about make their way into the immigrant Chinese church. I'm mostly thankful because you're not pushing for every church to be everything. I think that's really important concept. Because I've always looked at the immigrant Chinese church and from a critical perspective and thought about, well, it should be doing this and this and this. But I think your response, our interview here has really helped me to rethink that concept. And maybe we should be thankful for what it can do and what it has been doing well. And while thinking about other things that it can do. But I think for the immigrant Chinese church, mostly it's the biggest challenges it's facing right now are how to reach out to these new generation of immigrants, right, who are very different from the leadership and their immigration experience. And then the second largest one is the dealing with the silent exodus, so the mass leaving of the next generation.
Okay, well, that's about all that we have time for. Andrew, do you have any final thoughts that you want to share with our listeners?
I'm not sure that I do. It's been great to be with you guys.
Oh,
I
love we've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I love what Chow just said about the immigrant church. Like, maybe everyone thought plan A was for this immigrant church to become like a Chinese American church and for their kids to grow up there. And then, you know, like it's a perpetuate. But, you know, if it's a silent exodus just out of a local congregation, but if it's an eventual exodus into another church, that's a win, right? And I think having a big view of the church helps us to appreciate these things, you know? So that's my final thought on what Chow just said.
That was a great closing thought.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you to all our listeners. Thank you to our wonderful guest, Andrew, for sharing his thoughts and his time. Please do tune in to the next episode, which we hope will be out sooner than this one because we slacked over summer, but we'll be back shortly. thank you, everyone.
And take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.